Welcome to the ProPublica podcast. I'm Abram Lustgarten, senior reporter for ProPublica, and today I'm here with Kurt Guyette, an investigative reporter with the ACLU in Michigan, who's been covering the Flint water crisis. So, Kurt, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate that. Give us a quick 30-second background, a cliff note, you know, about the water crisis in Flint and how it unfolded and how you intersected with this story or became involved with this story.
Well, I became involved in this story because my beat, essentially, is to cover issues involving Michigan's emergency manager law, which is the most extreme receivership law in the United States. I started going up to Flint because it's one of the cities in Michigan that was taken over by the state and run by an emergency manager with really unchecked powers. And one of the things that emergency manager did in April of 2014, unilaterally made the decision that Flint would switch from the Detroit system, which had been providing clean, safe water for 50 years, to the highly polluted and, in this case, more significant, highly corrosive Flint River, which, in combination with the fact that the state did not use mandatory corrosion control, started causing lead in plumbing and lead service lines to leach into people's water and expose residents of Flint to high levels of lead.
Now, we've heard a lot about this emergency manager, but not with a lot of explanation about what they do or why they were there. Why don't you back up a little bit and tell us, why is this significant? Why were you watching this person in this department in particular in the first place?
Under the state's emergency manager law, if a city, school district, county are found to be in severe financial distress, the governor can appoint an emergency manager who essentially usurps all the authority usually given to democratically elected city councils, mayors, school boards, county supervisors. And they have the power to break collective bargaining agreements, abolish existing ordinances, create new ordinances, sell off assets, cut health benefits to municipal retirees, essentially everything and actually more than elected officials can do. And the elected officials only have whatever power that the emergency manager chooses to give them. They only get as much salary as the emergency manager chooses to give them. So essentially, elected officials become the employees of these appointed emergency managers and lose all autonomy. The one thing that the emergency managers cannot do is miss a bond payment. Whatever else happens, they need to make sure that the banks get paid at all costs. And so, what essentially is the bottom line is that democracy is replaced by an austerity-driven autocracy. And obviously that's an issue that's very much of concern to the ACLU. And I was hired with a grant from the Ford Foundation to investigate and write about issues connected to, with this law.
So it's great that you bring that up. Can you explain a little bit what your role is with the ACLU? It's a little unusual with the title of investigative journalist. And also just tell us about your background in journalism before you went to the ACLU.
Yeah, it's not just unusual, it's unique, at least in terms of the ACLU. We are the only branch in the country to have somebody like me working for the ACLU. So it was very much an experiment when we started this off a little more than 2 years ago. I was hired as an investigative reporter here in December of 2013. Like I said, it was very much an experiment. Prior to that, I had been a journalist for about 30 years. About 25 years in the alternative press. The last 18, I was working at the Metro Times, an alternative newspaper in Detroit. That was my last job before coming here to the ACLU.
And how has this crossover role that you're finding yourself in now affected your ability to report on this issue, your access to both the officials you want to talk to or to documents that you might want to FOIA for and so forth?
Well, in terms of FOIA, I have more support than ever in this job. I have a substantial budget to pay for FOIA documents. There is an attorney who is associated with the ACLU here that is a FOIA expert that provides me guidance and assistance whenever I need it. So in terms of that, my access is better than ever. In terms of the other way, it's a mixed bag. In reporting on the Flint crisis, the spokespeople for the city of Flint responded to me. The spokesperson for the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality completely blew me off and didn't answer my questions at all early on when I was trying to report on this. They just didn't respond at all, which that's their decision to make. They did talk to other press. When other press picked up on my reporting and started asking questions, they did respond to them, but not to me directly. At press conferences, the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality at one point tried to keep me from attending a press conference because they said I was not a credentialed reporter, but the legal team here pretty quickly came up with some cases that established precedent that they could not rightly keep me out of something like that. But then the press conferences were very carefully stage managed, and the last thing that they were going to do was call on me in those press conferences. And so in some ways, in this case specifically, my access has been somewhat limited, but that's not really a big concern to me. When I have the documents that I had, it's up to them whether they want to respond to or not, and it doesn't affect the story too much, their lack of response. You know, we just keep pushing forward.
Take us back to the issues here. How did the crisis in Flint unfold from your perspective? You're scrutinizing the role of this emergency manager, and what happened? And was there a significant turning point for you in that differentiated your reporting from what others had been tracking so far?
Well, there was a couple of things that happened. So I started going up there in February of 15, which was about 10 months after the switch, which occurred in April of 14. In January of 15, it was publicly disclosed that there were high levels of a carcinogenic byproduct of a chlorine in the water, TTHMs, and that people were pretty outraged that the city and state had known for months that this was in the water, but they were not legally required to disclose that fact, and so they didn't. When it was disclosed, people were rightfully very upset that they weren't told much sooner. The first meeting I went to was in February of 15. One of the emergency managers, because there's been a series of emergency managers that have been in place in Flint, was being confronted by citizens who were asking him why they weren't told about the TTHM problem, and he responded, as soon as we found out about it, we started to address it. People in the audience said, yeah, but that's not telling us. They're trying to evade them, saying, as soon as we found out about it, we addressed it, started to address it. They said, yeah, but that's not telling us about it, at which point the emergency manager just looked at the crowd and said, well, I'm telling you now. And it was just, the tone of his voice was so callous and so dismissive, and certainly not the tone that any public official that is in office because of constituents voting them there. He had no obligation to the people of Flint. He had no actual accountability to the people of Flint. And so he could really treat them however he wanted. And that really was, to some extent, a crystallizing moment for me. Then what happened was that one of the residents, this mom named Leanne Walters, found out that her child had been exposed to elevated levels of lead and went on a mission to get to the bottom of what caused the problem. She found a guy in the EPA named Miguel Del Toro, who is really the unsung hero in this story, who began working with her closely, arranged for Professor Mark Edwards at Virginia Tech to do independent analysis of her water, and found that one of the samples showed levels 2.5 times what it takes to be classified as hazardous waste going into her home because of the lead contamination was so high. Del Toro wrote a memo talking about not just the problem at this one particular home, but the fact that the highly corrosive river water was not being treated with corrosion control chemicals as the law required. Being a longtime EPA employee, he was concerned that that memo would get watered down and buried in the bureaucracy, and so he gave a copy of it to Leanne Walters, because of a short documentary that filmmaker Kate Levy and I had just released right around the time that Del Toro had written that memo and gave it to Ms. Walters. She felt that we could be trusted to tell the truth and get the word out. She gave the memo to us. We published it, and that was really the first crack in the dam of secrecy about what was going on regarding lead levels in Flint's water.
Incredible. And you also, if I understand correctly, had begun going door to door and collecting water samples yourself. Is that correct? Can you tell us about that?
Well, what happened was that after the memo and my story about it were published, the spokesman for the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, then spokesman, a guy named Brad Werfel, told Michigan Radio, which picked very quickly up on our story, really the only area media that really did a good job of picking up on it and pursuing it, talked to Mr. Werfel. Mr. Werfel's response was that when it comes to lead in their water, the people of Flint can, quote, just relax. There is no widespread problem regarding lead in Flint's water. So at that point, it was a he said, she said kind of story. Del Toro, who was being portrayed as a rogue employee, didn't properly vet his memo before releasing it, versus the MDEQ, which said based on tests it had been doing, could say with certainty that the lead met federal standards and was safe. And so the question became, how do you get to the truth? And the answer was that to do an independent test of the water. We, being the ACLU of Michigan, began talking with residents. There was a group there called the Coalition for Clean Water. And then Mark Edwards at Virginia Tech, MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, who had discovered the lead problem in Washington, D.C.'s water in the early 2000s. He applied for an emergency grant from the National Science Foundation to send 300 test kits to Flint. Me, working with the residents, to help distribute those kits. When we got to 200, we mapped out where everything had been distributed to see parts of the city that were underrepresented, and went out knocking on doors, making sure that, you know, we had as broad and a fair distribution as possible in order to shield ourselves from any criticism that we were cherry-picking locations or anything like that, and went out into the neighborhoods and started collecting samples from homeowners, and I was part of that effort. I saw it really as an extension of a journalistic investigation. I was just trying to find out what the truth was about lead levels in the water, and this is how to do it.
And where was other local and state media on this story as it evolved for you, and in particular as you entered the stage of going out and collecting water test results yourself?
You know, it was kind of slow in building. Michigan Radio jumped on it right away and did a very good job of reporting what they saw as going on based on the memo and moving the story forward. Local media began to pick up on it. As soon as we started collecting water samples and sending it back to Virginia Tech, by the time they had analyzed the first 24 samples from homes, they could tell that it was going to be a problem just based on statistically the amount of lead that they were finding that quickly. And so they set up a website, started posting information about what they saw as a public health crisis on their website, and that they also started calling people with high levels of lead in the water to warn them not to drink the water. I was reporting on those results as they became available. The Flint Journal, which is the local daily there, began following it at that point. Mid-September, we held a press conference to announce what Virginia Tech had found after it had it analyzed. Out of the 300 kits that got distributed, we had collected 277, which is an incredibly high number. And this is the thing that needs to be emphasized, is how much this was driven by people in the community. You know, it wasn't because of me that there was 277 collected. It was because the people of Flint that we were working with wanted to, they were actually disappointed that they didn't get all 300, because they are absolutely driven to have this be as scientifically valid test as possible, to make this done every way possible to make it bulletproof, because we knew that we were going to get criticized, and we didn't want to give any legitimate openings to that criticism. And so they were scrupulous in how they were conducting this effort, and relentless in getting out there.
I mean, would you hazard a guess as to, or your perception anyway, about what stood in the way of other local and state media carrying this story forward, you know, in an investigative way?
Well, I think that in some ways they might have been almost numbed by the fact that the state had repeatedly claimed that the water was safe. And they said, look, here's the test that proved that the water is safe. But they did a good job of, because we just got done putting together a documentary on this issue, and we relied on the local reporting, the Flint Journal's reporting, covering sort of the step-by-step aspect of it, which is one of the important functions of the local press. But also, I think that it's probably safe to say that these reporters working at smaller news outlets, they're producing a lot of copy. And now, you know, I don't know specifically what it's like at the Flint Journal. I know what it's like at the alternative paper where I previously worked. There's a lot of emphasis now on people producing a certain number of blogs every day. So having somebody with the time and resources that I have that can really dig into it, something like this, start filing FOIAs on something like this, and really dedicate the time to focus on something like this is a luxury that people at smaller, even mid-sized papers don't have. I mean, when they applied for the grant here, one of the points that they made was that how investigative journalism at really all levels is being cut back on, and that by hiring somebody like me, they could help fill the void.
And where do you go from here on this issue? Are you looking elsewhere into the emergency manager system, or are you still on the Flint story? What's next?
Both. I'm still pursuing information on the Flint story. I don't think all the questions have been answered yet. I mean, one thing that's very different now than back in July is that there's all sorts of media looking at this now. You know, welcome them with open arms. You know, the more hounds on the trail, the better. And that's another part of my job that's a little bit unusual, in that not only am I in competition with other reporters in some way, I'm also here as a resource for other reporters, because the most important thing is to get this information out, however it gets out. And if that involves me spending time giving other reporters a full briefing on the background of this so they completely understand it, so they have a solid base moving forward, well, then that's part of my job as well.
What is it specifically that you want to know? What additional information are you looking for next that would carry the story of Flint, Michigan forward? And what's it going to take for you to get it?
Well, I am have FOIA outstanding with the city at this point that I'm waiting to get. But questions about what was known about the river before the switch was made, because at one point the city, while under emergency management, was looking for a new water source, or to change water sources as a way of saving money. A new pipeline is being built from Lake Huron to Genesee County, where Flint is located. They were considering joining that pipeline. They considered staying on Detroit. They considered having the Flint River as the long-term source of water for the city. That was rejected as the long-term source. Ultimately, it was decided that they would go to the pipeline, and that's when the emergency manager made the decision to use the river as a short-term source while the pipeline was being built. So why was it that the river was okay to use as a interim source but not as a permanent source? That's a question.
And do you have suspicions about what the answer to that might be?
You know, I don't know, and I don't like to speculate about stuff, so I'm not sure. But the other question is, and this was in an interview that we did with the former director of public works for the city of Flint, was that he said that the decision to switch to the river came out of the governor's office. And that when I asked the governor's spokeswoman about that, she wouldn't give me a straight answer to that question. And so it's still out there hanging whether the governor's office was actually directly involved in making the decision, this fateful decision, this catastrophic decision to switch to the river. And so that's something else that I'm trying to get to the bottom of. And I think eventually, you know, I don't know what the answer is at this point, but the governor's going to be in front of Congress pretty soon under oath. Maybe that question will come up at that point.
And the things that you've learned about how this story has unfolded, you know, initial assessments that the water was clean, the methodology of testing and sampling these neighborhoods, however misrepresented it was, what does that make you believe, or what concerns does it raise about these issues more broadly, beyond Flint, maybe even beyond Michigan, you know, about how safe tight our environmental protections are, our clean water regulations, and how many other communities, you know, if any, might be vulnerable to similar kinds of situations?
Well, the estimate that I heard when covering EPA hearing about potential changes to what's known as the lead and copper rule going forward is that there's 10 million lead service lines throughout the United States. Leanne Walters, the mom that was initially involved, is really now on a mission to, you know, do whatever she can to keep other families from going through what her family has found. You know, she's researched on her own and found that there's a number of states that do what Michigan was doing, which is finding loopholes in the law that allow them to conduct their water testing in ways that are guaranteed to minimize the amount of lead that they find, because no one wants to be out of compliance and have to pay to start replacing these lead service lines, which, you know, cost maybe on average $4,000 to replace. And so this does speak to a larger issue about sampling that's occurring not just in Michigan, but in a number of other states, and whether people are actually doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is trying to find lead where lead is most likely to exist, or are they trying to minimize what they're finding in order to ensure that they're in compliance and not have to start shelling out money to replace these lead service lines. So this does bring to light a much, much bigger issue that is a significant issue.
Well, let's leave it on that note. Kurt Guyette, thank you for taking the time to talk with us. You've done really fantastic work on this issue, brought some very important information to light. Kurt Guyette is an investigative reporter with the ACLU in Michigan, closely covered the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. Thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate that.
Oh, it's been a very much a pleasure talking to you, and honored to talk to your group. I have the utmost respect for what you guys do. Hold it in high regard.
Thank you for listening to the ProPublica podcast. We'll be back next week.